In fact, we were now within a year of the end of the war in Europe. Slowly the emphasis came to be on preparing for peace. And among the peacetime activities, which began to take an increasing amount of my time, was politics. Almost as soon as I came up to Oxford, I had joined the Oxford University Conservative Association, AUCA, as it was called. I made friends in university politics, who, as in the novels of Anthony Powell, kept reappearing in my life as the years passed by. Much the closest was Edward Boyle. Although he moved easily in a sophisticated social and political world which I had only glimpsed, shared with me a serious interest in politics. At this time, Edward was himself a classical liberal, whose views chimed in pretty well with my own provincial middle-class conservatism. Although we were later to diverge politically, we remained dear friends until his tragically early death. William Rees-Mogg, whom I knew in my final year, became a distinguished editor of the Times at a very early age. Even in those days, one sensed that there was something formidable behind his somewhat formal appearance and that he was marked out for greater things. Robin Day was a prominent liberal. He was a leading light in the Oxford Union, and we later met as lawyers in the same chambers. One sometimes wondered what career would be open to the brilliant wits of the Union until Robin Day invented a new one by pioneering television interviewing, after which our paths and our swords crossed frequently. Another star was Tony Benn, at that time still rattling his full complement of syllables as the Honourable Anthony Wedgwood Benn. From start to finish, he and I have rarely agreed on anything, but he was always a courteous and effective debater, an English patriot, and as time has made socialism more and more a thing of the past, even a traditional figure. As an officer in AUCA, I was naturally taken up with the 1945 general election campaign. In Oxford, I was busy campaigning for the city's MP, Quinton Hogg, until term ended, when I returned to Grantham to work for Squadron Leader Worth in his attempt to dislodge the sitting independent member, Dennis Kendall. Looking back, we should all have known what to expect. By some mysterious but inexorable law, wars always seem to advance state control and those who advocate it. The left were extremely effective after Dunkirk in portraying the conservatives as exclusively responsible for appeasement and managed by skillful sleight of hand to distance Churchill from the party he led. But there were other influences at work. The command economy required in wartime conditions had habituated many people to an essentially socialist mentality. Within the armed forces, left-wing intellectuals had exerted a powerful influence through the Army Education Corps, which, as Nigel Birch MP shrewdly observed, was, and I quote, the only regiment with a general election among its battle honors. At home, broadcasters like J.B. Priestley gave a comfortable yet idealistic gloss to social progress in a left-wing direction. I vividly remember sitting in a student common room in Somerville, listening to Churchill's famous, or notorious, election broadcast to the effect that socialism would require some sort of Gestapo to enforce it, and instinctively thinking, he's gone too far. Back in Grantham, I was one of the warm-up speakers for the Conservative candidate at village meetings. Looking back at the reports in the local newspapers of what I said at the time, there's little with which I would disagree now. Germany must be disarmed and brought to justice. There must be cooperation with America and, somewhat less realistically, with the Soviet Union. The British Empire, the most important community of peoples of the world had ever known, must never be dismembered. Perhaps not very realistic either, but my view of Britain's imperial future was not uncommon in the aftermath of victory. The main argument I advanced for voting conservative was that by doing so, we would keep Winston Churchill in charge of our foreign policy. 3 weeks after polling day, by which time the overseas and service votes had been returned, I went to the election count at Sleaford. As we waited for the Grantham result, news trickled in of what was happening elsewhere. It was bad, and it became worse. A Labour landslide, with Tory cabinet ministers falling one after the other. Then our own candidate lost too. I was shocked and upset. I simply couldn't understand how the electorate could do this to Churchill. On my way back home, I met a friend, someone who I had always thought was a staunch conservative, and said how shocked I was by the terrible news. He was not shocked at all. In fact, he said, he thought the news was rather good. Incomprehension deepened. In retrospect, the election of the 1945-51 Labour government seems the logical fulfilment of the collectivist spirit that came to dominate wartime Britain. It was to be about 35 years before this collectivism would run its course, shaping and distorting British society in the process, before it collapsed in 1979's winter of discontent.